later. Could he just be sitting silently in that room? Our approach has been quiet enough, but with this many people pressing in on him, he must have noticed. Anyone trying to make it through life as a warrior would notice. Otherwise, he'd be dead by now. Maybe he's dozed off. It rather looks that way. After all, he's been waiting a long time. On the other hand, he's already proved he's clever. He's probably standing there fully prepared for battle, leaving the lamp lit to put us off guard, just waiting for the first man to attack. That must be it. That is it! The men were edgily cautious, for the target of their murderous intent would be just as eager to slay them. They exchanged glances, silently asking who would be the first to run forward and risk his life. Finally, the wily Toji, who was just outside Musashi's room, called out, "Musashi! Sorry to have kept you waiting. Could I see you for a moment?" There being no answer, Toji concluded that Musashi was indeed ready and waiting for the attack. Vowing not to let him escape, Toji signaled to right and left, then aimed a kick at the shoji. Dislodged from its groove by the blow, the bottom of the door slid about 2 feet into the room. At the sound, the men who were supposed to storm into the room unintentionally fell back a pace. But in a matter of seconds, someone shouted for the attack, and all the other doors of the room clattered open. "He's not here! The room's empty!" Voices full of restored courage muttered disbelievingly. Musashi had been sitting there just a short while ago when someone had brought him the lamp. The lamp still burned, the cushion he had been sitting on was still there, the brazier still had a good fire in it, and there was a cup of untouched tea. But no Musashi. One man ran out on the veranda and let the others know that he had gotten away. From under the veranda and from dark spots in the garden, students and retainers assembled, stamping the ground angrily and cursing the men who had been standing guard in the small room. The guards, however, insisted that Musashi could not have gotten away. He had walked down to the toilet less than an hour earlier, but had returned to the room immediately. There was no way he could have gotten out without being seen. "Are you saying he's invisible, like the wind?" one man asked scornfully. Just then a man who had been poking around in a closet shouted, "Here's how he got away! See? These floorboards have been ripped up!" "It hasn't been very long since the lamp was trimmed. He can't have gone far. After him!" If Musashi had indeed fled, he must at heart be a coward. The thought fired his pursuers with the fighting spirit that had been so notably lacking a bit earlier. They were streaming out the front, back inside gates, when someone yelled, "There he is!" Near the back gate, a figure shot out of the shadows, crossed the street, and entered a dark alley on the other side. Running like a hare, it swerved off to one side when it reached the wall at the end of the alley. Two or three of the students caught up with the man on the road between the Kyuyado and the burned ruins of the Honnoji. "Coward! Run away, will you? After what you did today?" There was the sound of heavy scuffling and kicking, and a defiant howl. The captured man had regained his strength and was turning on his captors. In an instant, the three men who had been dragging him by the back of his neck plummeted to the ground. The man's sword was about to descend on them when a fourth man ran up and shouted, "Wait! It's a mistake! He's not the one we're after!" Matahachi lowered his sword and the men got to their feet. "Hey, you're right! That's not Musashi!" As they were standing there looking perplexed, Toji arrived on the scene. "Did you catch him?" he asked.
Wrong man. Not the one who caused all the trouble."
Toji took a closer look at the captive and said with astonishment,
"Is that the man you were chasing?"
"Yes.
You know him?"
"I saw him just today at the Yomogi tea house."
While they eyed Matahachi silently and suspiciously, he calmly straightened his tousled hair and brushed off his kimono.
"Is he the master of the Yomogi?"
"No, the mistress of the place told me he wasn't. He seems to be just a hanger-on of some sort."
"He looks shady, all right. What was he doing around the gate? Spying?"
But Toji had already started to move on.
"If we waste time with him, we'll lose Musashi. Split up and get moving. If nothing else, we can at least find out where he's staying."
There was a murmur of assent, and they were off.
Matahachi, facing the moat of the Honnoji, stood silently with his head bowed while the men ran by. As the last one passed, he called out to him. The man stopped.
"What do you want?"
he asked. Going toward him, Matahachi asked, "How old was this man called Musashi?"
"How would I know?"
"Would you say he was about my age?"
"I guess that's about right. Yes."
"Is he from the village of Miyamoto in Mimasaka province?"
"Yes."
"I guess Musashi is another way of reading the two characters used to write Takezo, isn't it?"
"Why are you asking all these questions? Is he a friend of yours?"
"Oh, no. I was just wondering."
"Well, in the future, why don't you just stay away from places where you don't belong? Otherwise, you might find yourself in some real trouble one of these days."
With that warning, the man ran off.
Matahachi started walking slowly beside the dark moat, stopping occasionally to look up at the stars. He didn't seem to have any particular destination.
"It is him, after all," he decided. "He must have changed his name to Musashi and become a swordsman. I guess he must be pretty different from the way he used to be."
He slid his hands into his obi and began kicking a stone along with the toe of his sandal. Every time he kicked, he seemed to see Takezo's face before him.
"It's not the right time," he mumbled. "I'd be ashamed for him to see me the way I am now. I've got enough pride not to want him to look down on me. If that Yoshioka bunch catches up with him, though, they're likely to kill him. Wonder where he is. I'd like to at least warn him."
Encounter and Retreat. Along the stony path leading up to the Kiyomizudera Temple stood a row of shabby houses, their planked roofs lined up like rotten teeth and so old that moss covered their eaves. Under the hot noonday sun, the street reeked of salted fish broiling over charcoal. A dish flew through the door of one of the ramshackle hovels and broke into smithereens on the street. A man of about 50, apparently an artisan of sorts, came tumbling out after it. Close on his heels was his barefooted wife, her hair a tangled mess and her tits hanging down like a cow's.
"What are you saying, you lout?" she screamed shrilly. "You go off, leave your wife and children to starve, then come crawling back like a worm?"
From inside the house came the sound of children crying, and nearby a dog howled. She caught up with the man, seized him by his topknot, and began beating him.
"Now where do you think you're going, you old fool?"
Neighbors rushed up, trying to restore order. Musashi smiled ironically and turned back toward the ceramics shop. For some time before the domestic battle erupted, he had been standing just outside it, watching the potters with childlike fascination. The two men inside were unaware of his presence. Eyes riveted on their work, they seemed to have entered into the clay, become a part of it. Their concentration was complete. Musashi would have liked to have a try at working with the clay. Since boyhood, he had enjoyed doing things with his hands, and he thought he might at least be able to make a simple tea bowl. Just then, however, one of the potters, an old man of nearly 60, started fashioning a tea bowl. Musashi, observing how deftly he moved his fingers and handled his spatula, realized he'd overestimated his own abilities.
"It takes so much technique just to make a simple piece like that," he marveled.
These days, he often felt deep admiration for other people's work. He found he respected technique, art, even the ability to do a simple task well, particularly if it was a skill he himself had not mastered. In one corner of the shop, on a makeshift counter made of an old door panel, stood rows of plates, jars, sake cups, and pitchers. They were sold as souvenirs, for the paltry sum of 20 or 30 pieces of cash, to people on their way to and from the temple. In stark contrast to the earnestness the potters devoted to their work was the humbleness of their boarded shack. Musashi wondered whether they always had enough to eat. Life, it appeared, wasn't as easy as it sometimes seemed. Contemplating the skill, concentration, and devotion put into making wares, even as cheap as these, made Musashi feel he still had a long way to go if he was ever to reach the level of perfection in swordsmanship that he aspired to. The thought was a sobering one, for in the past 3 weeks he'd visited other well-known training centers in Kyoto besides the Yoshioka School, and had begun to wonder whether he had not been too critical of himself since his confinement at Himeji. His expectation had been to find Kyoto full of men who had mastered the martial arts. It was, after all, the imperial capital, as well as the former seat of the Ashikaga shogunate, and it had long been a gathering place for famous generals and legendary warriors. During his stay, however, he had not found a single training center that had taught him anything to be genuinely grateful for. Instead, at each school he had experienced disappointment. Though he always won his bouts, he was unable to decide whether this was because he was good or his opponents were bad. In either case, if the samurai he had met were typical, the country was in sorry shape. Encouraged by his success, he had reached the point of taking a certain pride in his expertise, but now, reminded of the danger of vanity, he felt chastened. He mentally bowed in deep respect to the clay-smudged old men at the wheel and started up the steep slope to Kiyomizudera. He had not gone far when a voice called to him from below. "You there, sir! The Ronin!"
"Do you mean me?"
asked Musashi, turning around. Judging from the man's padded cotton garment, his bare legs, and the pole he carried, he was a palanquin bearer by trade. From behind his beard, he said, politely enough for one of his lowly status, "Sir, is your name Miyamoto?"
"Yes."
"Thank you." The man turned and went down toward Chawan Hill. Musashi watched him enter what appeared to be a tea house. Passing through the area a while earlier, he had noticed a large crowd of porters and palanquin bearers standing about in a sunny spot. He couldn't imagine who had sent one of them to ask his name, but supposed that whoever it was would soon come to meet him. He stood there a while, but when no one appeared, resumed his climb. He stopped along the way to look at several well-known temples, and at each of them he bowed and said two prayers. One was, "Please protect my sister from harm." The other was, "Please test the lowly Musashi with hardship. Let him become the greatest swordsman in the land, or let him die." Arriving at the edge of a cliff, he dropped his basket hat on the ground and sat down. From there, he could look out over the whole city of Kyoto. As he sat clasping his knees, a simple but powerful ambition welled up in his young breast. "I want to lead an important life. I want to do it because I was born a human being." He had once read that in the 10th century, two rebels named Taira no Masakado and Fujiwara no Sumitomo, both wildly ambitious, had gotten together and decided that if they emerged from the wars victorious, they would divide Japan up between them. The story was probably apocryphal to begin with, but Musashi remembered thinking at the time how stupid and unrealistic it would have been for them to believe they could carry out so grandiose a scheme. Now, however, he no longer felt it laughable. While his own dream was of a different sort, there were certain similarities. If the young cannot harbor great dreams in their souls, who can? At the moment, Musashi was imagining how he could create a place of his own in the world. He thought of Oda Nobunaga and Toyotomi Hideyoshi, of their visions of unifying Japan, and of the many battles they had fought to that end. but it was clear that the path to greatness no longer lay in winning battles. Today, the people wanted only the peace for which they'd thirsted so long. And as Musashi considered the long, long struggle Tokugawa Ieyasu had had to endure to make this desire a reality, he realized once again how hard it was to hold fast to one's ideal. "This is a new age," he thought. "I have the rest of my life before me. I came along too late to follow in the footsteps of Nobunaga or Hideyoshi, but I can still dream of my own world to conquer. No one can stop me from doing that. Even that palanquin bearer must have a dream of some sort." For a moment, he put these ideas out of his mind and tried to view his situation objectively. He had his sword, and the way of the sword was the way he had chosen. It might be fine to be a Hideyoshi or an Ieyasu, but the times no longer had use for people of their particular talents. Ieyasu had everything neatly tied up. There was no more need for bloody wars. In Kyoto, stretched out below him, life was no longer a touch-and-go affair. For Musashi, the important thing from now on would be his sword and the society around him, his swordsmanship as it related to existing as a human being. In a moment of insight, he was satisfied that he had found the link between the martial arts and his own visions of greatness. As he sat lost in thought, the palanquin bearer's face came into view beneath the cliff. He pointed his bamboo pole at Musashi and shouted, "There he is, up there!" Musashi looked down to where the porters were milling about and shouting. They began climbing the hill toward him. He got to his feet and, trying to ignore them, walked farther up the hill, but soon discovered that his path was blocked. Locking arms and thrusting out their poles, a sizable group of men had encircled him at a distance. Looking over his shoulder, he saw that the men behind him had come to a halt. One of them grinned, showing his teeth, and informed the others that Musashi seemed to be staring at a plaque or something. Musashi, now before the steps of the Hongan-do, was indeed gazing up at a weather-beaten plaque hanging from the crossbeam of the temple entrance. He felt ill at ease and wondered if he should try frightening them away with a battle cry. Even though he knew he could make quick work of them, there was no point in brawling with a bunch of lowly laborers. It was probably all a mistake anyway. If so, they would disperse sooner or later. He stood there patiently, reading and rereading the words on the plaque. "Original vow." "Here she comes," one of the porters cried. They began talking among themselves in hushed tones. Musashi's impression was that they were working themselves into a frenzy. The compound within the western gate of the temple had quickly filled with people, and now priests, pilgrims, and vendors were straining their eyes to see what was going on. Their faces brimming with curiosity, they formed circles outside the ring of porters surrounding Musashi. From the direction of Sanneng Hill came the rhythmical, pace-setting chants of men carrying a load. The voices came closer and closer until two men entered the temple grounds, bearing on their backs an old woman and a rather tired-looking country samurai. From her porter's back, Osugi waved her hand briskly and said, "This will do." The bearer bent his legs, and as she jumped spryly to the ground, she thanked him. Turning to Uncle Gon, she said, "We won't let him get away this time, will we?" The two were clothed and shod as though they expected to spend the rest of their lives traveling. "Where is he?" called Osugi. One of the bearers said, "Over there," and pointed proudly toward the temple. Uncle Gon moistened the handle of his sword with spittle, and the two pushed through the circle of people. "Take your time," cautioned one of the porters. "He looks pretty tough," said another. "Just make sure you're well prepared," advised still another. While the laborers offered words of encouragement and support to Osugi, the spectators looked on in dismay.
Is the old woman actually planning to challenge that ronin to a duel?
Looks that way.
But she's so old. Even her second is shaky on his legs. They must have good reason to try taking on a man so much younger.
Must be a family feud of some kind.
Look at that now, will you? She's lighting into the old man. Some of these old grannies really have guts, don't they?
A porter ran up with a dipper of water for Osugi. After drinking a mouthful, she handed it to Uncle Gong and addressed him sternly.
Now see that you don't get flustered, because there's nothing to be flustered about. Takezo's a man of straw. Oh, he may have learned a little about using a sword, but he couldn't have learned all that much. Just stay calm.
Taking the lead, she went straight to the front staircase of the Hongando and sat down on the steps, not 10 paces from Musashi. Paying no attention whatever, either to him or to the crowd watching her, she took out her prayer beads and, closing her eyes, began moving her lips. Inspired by her religious fervor, Uncle Gom put his hands together and did likewise. The sight proved to be a little too melodramatic, and one of the spectators started snickering. Immediately, one of the porters spun around and said challengingly,
"Who thinks this is funny? This is no laughing matter, you imbecile! The old woman's come all the way from Mimasaka to find the good-for-nothing who ran off with her son's bride. She's been praying at the temple here every day for almost 2 months, and today he finally showed up."
"These samurai are different from the rest of us,"
was the opinion of another porter.
"At that age, the old woman could be living comfortably at home, playing with her grandchildren, but no, here she is, in place of her son, seeking to avenge an insult to her family. If nothing else, she deserves our respect."
A third one said,
"We're not supporting her just because she's been giving us tips. She's got spirit, she has. Old as she is, she's not afraid to fight. I say we should give her all the help we can. It's only right to help the underdog. If she should lose, let's take care of the ronin ourselves."
"You're right, but let's do it now. We can't stand here and let her get herself killed."
As the crowd learned of the reasons for Osugi's being there, the excitement mounted. Some of the spectators began goading the porters on. Osugi put her prayer beads back into her kimono, and a hush fell over the temple grounds.
"Takezo!"
she called loudly, putting her left hand on the short sword at her waist. Musashi had all the while been standing by in silence. Even when Osugi called out his name, he acted as if he hadn't heard. Unnerved by this, Uncle Gong, at Osugi's side, chose this moment to assume an attacking stance, and thrusting his head forward, uttered a cry of challenge. Musashi again failed to respond. He couldn't. He simply did not know how to. He recalled Takuan's having warned him in Himeji that he might run into Osugi. He was prepared to ignore her completely, but he was very upset by the talk the porters had been spreading among the mob. Furthermore, it was difficult for him to restrain his resentment at the hatred the Hongidens had harbored against him all this time. The whole affair amounted to nothing more than a petty matter of face and feelings in the little village of Miyamoto, a misunderstanding that could be easily cleared up if only Matahachi were present. Nevertheless, he was at a loss as to what to do here and now. How was one to respond to a challenge from a doddering old woman and a shrunken-faced samurai? Musashi stared on in silence, his mind in a quandary.
"Look at that bastard! He's afraid!"
a porter shouted.
"Be a man! Let the old woman kill you!" taunted another.
There was not a soul who was not on Osugi's side. The old woman blinked her eyes and shook her head. Then she looked at the bearers and snapped angrily,
"Shut up! I just want you as witnesses! If the two of us should happen to be killed, I want you to send our bodies back to Miyamoto.
Otherwise, I don't need your talk, and I don't want your help."
Pulling her short sword partway out of its scabbard, she took a couple of steps in Musashi's direction.
"Takezo!" she said again. "Takezo was always your name in the village, so why don't you answer to it? I've heard you've taken a fine new name, Miyamoto Musashi, is it? But you'll always be Takezo to me."
Her wrinkled neck quivered as she laughed. Evidently, she hoped to kill Musashi with words before swords were drawn.
"Did you think you could keep me from tracking you down just by changing your name? How stupid! The gods in heaven have guided me to you, as I knew they would. Now fight! We'll see whether I take your head home with me, or you manage somehow to stay alive."
Uncle Gong, in his withered voice, issued his own challenge.
"It's been 4 long years since you gave us the slip, and we've been searching for you all this time. Now our prayers here at the Kiyomizudera have brought you into our grasp. Old I may be, but I'm not going to lose to the likes of you. Prepare to die!"
Whipping out his sword, he cried to Osugi,
"Get out of the way!"
She turned on him furiously.
"What do you mean, you old fool? You're the one who's shaking."
"Never mind. The bodhisattvas of this temple will protect us."
"You're right, Uncle Gong. And the ancestors of the Hongidens are with us, too. There's nothing to fear."
"Takezo, come forward and fight."
"What are you waiting for?"
Musashi did not move. He stood there like a deaf mute, staring at the two old people and their drawn swords. Osugi cried,
"What's the matter, Takezo? Are you scared?"
She edged sideways, preparing to attack, but suddenly tripped on a rock and pitched forward, landing on her hands and knees almost at Musashi's feet. The crowd gasped, and someone screamed,
"She'll be killed! Quick, save her!"
But Uncle Gon only stared at Musashi's face, too stunned to move. The old woman then startled one and all by snatching up her sword and walking back to Uncle Gon's side, where she again took a challenging stance.
"What's wrong, you lout?" Osugi cried. "Is that sword in your hand just an ornament? Do you know how to use it?"
Musashi's face was like a mask, but he spoke at last in a thunderous voice.
"I can't do it!"
He started walking toward them, and Uncle Gon and Osugi instantly fell back to either side.
Where are you going, Takezo?
"I can't use my sword."
"Stop! Why don't you stop and fight?"
"I told you, I can't use it."
He walked straight ahead, looking neither right nor left. He marched directly through the crowd without once swerving. Recovering her senses, Osugi cried,
"He's running away! Don't let him escape!"
The crowd now moved in on Musashi, but when they thought they had him hemmed in, they discovered he was no longer there. Their bewilderment was acute. Eyes flared in surprise, then became dull patches in blank faces. Breaking up into smaller groups, they continued until sunset to run about, searching frantically under the floors of the temple buildings and in the woods for their vanished prey. Still later, as people were going back down the darkened slopes of Sangeng and Chawan Hills, one man swore that he had seen Musashi jump with the effortlessness of a cat to the top of the 6-foot wall by the western gate and disappear. Nobody believed this, least of all Osugi and Uncle Gong. The Water Sprite. In a hamlet northwest of Kyoto, the heavy thuds of a mallet pounding rice straw shook the ground. Unseasonal torrents of rain soaked into the brooding thatched roofs. This was a sort of no man's land between the city and the farming district. and the poverty was so extreme that at twilight the smoke of kitchen fires billowed from only a handful of houses. A basket hat suspended under the eaves of one small house proclaimed in bold, rough characters that this was an inn, albeit one of the cheapest variety. The travelers who stopped here were impecunious and rented only floor space. For pallets, they paid extra, but few could afford such luxury. In the dirt-floored kitchen beside the entranceway, a boy leaned with his hands on the raised tatami of the adjoining room, in the center of which was a sunken hearth.
"Hello! Good evening! Anybody here?"
It was the errand boy from the drinking shop, another shabby affair just down the road. The boy's voice was too loud for his size. He could not have been more than 10 or 11 years old, and with his hair wet from the rain and hanging down over his ears, he looked no more substantial than a water sprite in a whimsical painting. He was dressed for the part, too. Thigh-length kimono with tubular sleeves, a thick cord for an obi, and mud splattered clear up his back from running in his wooden clogs.
"That you, Joel?"
called the old innkeeper from a back room.
"Yes. Would you like me to bring you some sake?" "No, not today. The lodger isn't back yet. I don't need any." "Well, he'll want some when he does come back, won't he? I'll bring the usual amount." "If he does, I'll come get it myself."
Reluctant to leave without an order, the boy asked, "What are you doing in there?"
"I'm writing a letter, going to send it by the pack horse up to Kurama tomorrow, but it's a bit difficult, and my back's getting sore. Be quiet. Don't bother me."
"That's pretty funny, isn't it? You're so old, you're beginning to stoop, and you still don't know how to write properly."
"That's enough of you. If I hear any more sass, I'll take a stick of firewood to you."
"Want me to write it for you?"
"Ha! As if you could."
"Oh, I can," the boy asserted as he came into the room. He looked over the old man's shoulder at the letter and burst into laughter.
"Are you trying to write potatoes? The character you've written means pole." "Quiet."
"I won't say a word if you insist, but your writing's terrible. Are you planning to send your friends some potatoes or some poles?"
"Potatoes."
The boy read a moment longer, then announced, "It's no good. Nobody but you could guess what this letter's supposed to mean."
"Well, if you're so smart, see what you can do with it then."
"All right, just tell me what you want to say." Jotaro sat down and took up the brush.
"You clumsy ass," the old man exclaimed.
"Why call me clumsy? You're the one who can't write."
"Your nose is dripping on the paper."
"Oh, sorry. You can give me this piece for my pay." He proceeded to blow his nose on the soiled sheet.
"Now, what is it you want to say?"
Holding the brush firmly, he wrote with ease as the old man dictated. Just as the letter was finished, the lodger returned, casually throwing aside a charcoal sack he had picked up somewhere to put over his head. Musashi, stopping by the door, wrung the water out of his sleeves and grumbled,
"I guess this will be the end of the plum blossoms."
In the 20-odd days Musashi had been there, the inn had come to seem like home. He was gazing out at the tree by the front gate, where pink blossoms had greeted his eye every morning since his arrival. The fallen petals lay scattered about in the mud. Entering the kitchen, he was surprised to catch a glimpse of the boy from the sake shop, head to head with the innkeeper. Curious as to what they were doing, he stole up behind the old man and peered over his shoulder. Jotaro looked up into Musashi's face, then hastily hid the brush and paper behind him.
"You shouldn't sneak up on people like that," he complained. "Let me see," said Musashi teasingly.
"No," said Jotaro with a defiant shake of his head. "Come on, show me," said Musashi. "Only if you buy some sake."
"Oh, so that's your game, is it? All right, I'll buy some."
"5 gills?"
"I don't need that much."
"3 gills?"
"Still too much."
"Well, how much? Don't be such a tightwad."
"Tightwad? Now, you know I'm only a poor swordsman.
Do you think I have money to throw away?
All right, I'll measure it out myself, give you your money's worth. But if I do, you have to promise to tell me some stories.
The bargaining concluded, Jotaro splashed cheerfully off into the rain. Musashi picked up the letter and read it. After a moment or two, he turned to the innkeeper and asked, "Did he really write this?"
"Yes. Amazing, isn't it? He seems very bright."
While Musashi went to the well, poured some cold water over himself, and put on dry clothes, the old man hung a pot over the fire and set out some pickled vegetables in a rice bowl. Musashi came back and sat down by the hearth.
"What's that rascal up to?" muttered the innkeeper. "He's taking a long time with the sake."
"How old is he?"
11, I think he said."
"Mature for his age, don't you think?"
I suppose it's because he's been working at the sake shop since he was 7. He runs up against all kinds there. Wagon drivers, the paper maker down the way, travelers, and what have you."
"I wonder how he learned to write so well."
"Is he really that good?"
"Well, his writing has a certain childish quality, but there's an appealing, what can I say, directness about it. If I had a swordsman in mind, I would say it shows spiritual breadth. The boy may eventually be somebody."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, become a real human being."
"Oh?"
The old man frowned, took the lid off the pot, and resumed his grumbling.
"Still not back. I'll bet he's dawdling somewhere."
He was about to put on his sandals and go for the sake himself when Jotaro returned.
"What have you been up to?"
he asked the boy.
"You've been keeping my guest waiting."
"I couldn't help it. There was a customer in the shop, very drunk, and he grabbed a hold of me and started asking a lot of questions."
"What kind of questions?"
"He was asking about Miyamoto Musashi."
"And I suppose you did a lot of blabbering."
"It wouldn't matter if I did. Everybody around here knows what happened at Kiyomizudera the other day. The woman next door, the daughter of the lacquer man, both of them were at the temple that day. They saw what happened."
"Stop talking about that, won't you?" Musashi said, almost in a pleading tone.
The sharp-eyed boy sized up Musashi's mood and asked, "Can I stay here for a while and talk with you?" He started washing off his feet, preparing to come into the hearth room.
"It's all right with me, if your master won't mind."
"Oh, he doesn't need me right now."
"All right."
"I'll warm up your sake for you. I'm good at that." He settled the sake jar into the warm ashes around the fire and soon announced it was ready.
"Fast, aren't you?" said Musashi appreciatively.
"Do you like sake?"
"Yes."
"But being so poor, I guess you don't drink very much, do you?"
"That's right."
"I thought men who were good at the martial arts served under great lords and got big allowances. A customer at the shop told me once that Tsukahara Bokuden always used to go around with 70 or 80 retainers, a change of horses, and a falcon."
"That's true."
"And I heard that a famous warrior named Yagyu, who serves the house of Tokugawa, has an income of 50,000 bushels of rice."
"That's true, too."
"Then why are you so poor?"
"I'm still studying."
"How old will you have to be before you have lots of followers?"
"I don't know if I ever will."
"What's the matter? Aren't you any good?"
"You heard what the people who saw me at the temple said. Any way you look at it, I ran away."
"That's what everybody's saying. That shugyosha at the inn, that's you, is a weakling. But it makes me mad to listen to them."
Jotaro's lips tightened in a straight line. Why should you mind? They're not talking about you."
"Well, I feel sorry for you. Look, the papermaker's son and the cooper's son and some of the rest of the young men all get together sometimes behind the lacquer shop for sword practice. Why don't you fight one of them and beat him?"
"All right. If that's what you want, I will."
Musashi was finding it difficult to refuse anything the boy asked, partly because he himself was in many ways still a boy at heart and was able to sympathize with Jotaro. He was always looking, mostly unconsciously, for something to take the place of the family affection lacking from his own boyhood.
"Let's talk about something else," he said. I'll ask you a question for a change. Where were you born?
In Himeji.
Oh, so you're from Harima.
Yes, and you're from Mimasaka, aren't you?
Somebody said you were.
That's right.
What does your father do?
He used to be a samurai, a real honest-to-goodness samurai.
At first, Musashi looked astonished, but actually the answer explained several things, not the least of which was how the boy had learned to write so well. He asked the father's name.
His name is Aoki Tanzaemon. He used to have an allowance of 2,500 bushels of rice, but when I was 7, he left his lord's service and came to Kyoto as a ronin. After all his money was gone, he left me at the sake shop and went to a temple to become a monk. But I don't want to stay at the shop. I want to become a samurai like my father was, and I want to learn swordsmanship like you. Isn't that the best way to become a samurai?
The boy paused, then continued earnestly.
I want to become your follower. Go around the country studying with you. Won't you take me on as your pupil?
Having blurted out his purpose, Jotaro put on a stubborn face, reflecting clearly his determination not to take no for an answer. He could not know, of course, that he was pleading with a man who had caused his father no end of trouble. Musashi, for his part, could not bring himself to refuse out of hand. Yet what he was really thinking of was not whether to say yes or no, but of Aoki Tanzaemon and his unfortunate fate. He could not help sympathizing with the man. The way of the samurai was a constant gamble, and a samurai had to be ready at all times to kill or be killed. Mulling over this example of life's vicissitudes, Musashi was saddened, and the effect of the sake wore off quite suddenly. He felt lonely. Jotaro was insistent. When the innkeeper tried to get him to leave Musashi alone, he replied insolently and redoubled his efforts. He caught hold of Musashi's wrist, then hugged his arm, finally broke into tears. Musashi, seeing no way out, said, all right, that's enough. You can be my follower, but only after you go and talk it over with your master. Jotaro, satisfied at last, trotted off to the sake shop. The next morning, Musashi rose early, dressed, and called to the innkeeper. Would you please fix me a lunchbox? It's been nice staying here these few weeks, but I think I'll go on to Nara now.
Leaving so soon?
Asked the innkeeper, not expecting the sudden departure.
It's because that boy was pestering you, isn't it?
Oh no, it's not his fault. I've been thinking about going to Nara for some time, to see the famous lance fighters at the Hozoin. I hope he doesn't give you too much trouble when he finds out I'm gone.
Don't worry about it. He's only a child. He'll scream and yell for a while, then forget all about it.
I can't imagine that the sake man would let him leave anyway, said Musashi as he stepped out onto the road. The storm had passed, as if wiped away, and the breeze brushed gently against Musashi's skin, quite unlike the fierce wind of the day before. The Kamo River was up, the water muddy. At one end of the wooden bridge at Sanjo Avenue, samurai were examining all the people who came and went. Asking the reason for the inspection, Musashi was told it was because of the new shogun's impending visit. A vanguard of influential and minor feudal lords had already arrived, and steps were being taken to keep dangerous, unattached samurai out of the city. Musashi himself, a ronin, gave ready answers to the questions asked and was allowed to pass. The experience set him to thinking about his own status as a wandering, masterless warrior pledged neither to the Tokugawas nor to their rivals in Osaka. Running off to Sekigahara and taking sides with the Osaka forces against the Tokugawas was a matter of inheritance. That had been his father's allegiance, unchanged from the days when he served under Lord Shinmen of Iga. Toyotomi Hideyoshi had died 2 years before the battle. His supporters, loyal to his son, made up the Osaka faction. In Miyamoto, Hideyoshi was considered the greatest of heroes, and Musashi remembered how as a child he had sat at the hearth and listened to tales of the great warrior's prowess. These ideas, formed in his youth, lingered with him, and even now, if pressed to say which side he favored, he'd probably have said Osaka. Musashi had since learned a few things, and now recognized that his actions at the age of 17 had been both mindless and devoid of accomplishment. For a man to serve his lord faithfully, it was not enough to jump blindly into the fray and brandish a lance. He must go all the way to the brink of death.
"If a samurai dies with a prayer for his lord's victory on his lips, he has done something fine and meaningful,"
was the way Musashi would have put it now. But at the time, neither he nor Matahachi had had any sense of loyalty. What they had been thirsting for was fame and glory, and more to the point, a means of gaining a livelihood without giving up anything of their own. It was odd that they should have thought of it that way. Having since learned from Takuan that life is a jewel to be treasured, Musashi knew that far from giving up nothing, he and Matahachi had unwittingly been offering their most precious possession. Each had literally wagered everything he had on the hope of receiving a paltry stipend as a samurai. In retrospect, he wondered how they could have been so foolish. He noticed that he was approaching Daigo, south of the city, and since he'd worked up quite a sweat, decided to stop for a rest. From a distance, he heard a voice shouting,
"Wait! Wait!"
Gazing far down the steep mountain road, he made out the form of the little water sprite Jotaro, running for all he was worth. Presently, the boy's angry eyes were glaring into his.
"You lied to me!" Jotaro shouted. "Why did you do that?"
Breathless from running, face flushed, he spoke with belligerence, though it was clear he was on the verge of tears. Musashi had to laugh at his getup. He had discarded the work clothes of the day before in favor of an ordinary kimono, but it was only half big enough for him, the skirt barely reaching his knees and the arm stopping at the elbows. At his side hung a wooden sword that was longer than the boy was tall, on his back a basket hat that looked as big as an umbrella. Even as he shouted at Musashi for having left him behind, he burst into tears. Musashi hugged and tried to comfort him, but the boy wailed on, apparently feeling that in the mountains, with no one around, he could let himself go. Finally, Musashi said,
"Does it make you feel good, acting like a crybaby?"
"I don't care," Jotaro sobbed. "You're a grown-up, and yet you lied to me. You said you'd let me be your follower, then went off and left me. Are grown-ups supposed to act like that?"
"I'm sorry," said Musashi. This simple apology turned the boy's crying into a pleading whine.
"Stop it now," said Musashi. "I didn't mean to lie to you, but you have a father and you have a master. I couldn't bring you with me unless your master consented. I told you to go and talk with him, didn't I? Didn't seem likely to me that he'd agree."
"Why didn't you at least wait until you heard the answer?"
"That's why I'm apologizing to you now. Did you really discuss this with him?"
"Yes."
He got his sniffling under control and pulled two leaves from a tree on which he blew his nose.
"And what did he say?"
"He told me to go ahead."
"Did he now?"
"He said no self-respecting warrior or training school would take on a boy like me, but since the samurai at the inn was a weakling, he ought to be just the right person. He said maybe you could use me to carry your luggage, and he gave me this wooden sword as a going-away present."
Musashi smiled at the man's line of reasoning.
"After that," continued the boy, "I went to the inn. The old man wasn't there, so I just borrowed his hat from off the hook under the eaves."
"But that's the inn's signboard. It has lodgings written on it."
"Oh, I don't mind. I need a hat in case it rains."
It was clear from Jotaro's attitude that as far as he was concerned, all necessary promises and vows had been exchanged, and he was now Musashi's disciple. Sensing this, Musashi resigned himself to being more or less stuck with the child, but it also occurred to him that maybe it was all for the best. Indeed, When he considered his own part in Tanzaimon's loss of status, he concluded that perhaps he should be grateful for the opportunity to see to the boy's future. It seemed the right thing to do. Jotaro, now calm and reassured, suddenly remembered something and reached inside his kimono.
I almost forgot. I have something for you. Here it is.
He pulled out a letter. Eyeing it curiously, Musashi asked, Where did you get that?
Remember last night I said there was a ronin drinking at the shop, asking a lot of questions?
Yes.
Well, when I went home, he was still there. He kept on asking about you. He's some drinker, too. Drank a whole bottle of sake by himself. Then he wrote this letter and asked me to give it to you.
Musashi cocked his head to one side in puzzlement and broke the seal. Looking first at the bottom, he saw it was from Matahachi, who must have been drunk indeed. Even the characters looked tipsy. As Musashi read the scroll, he was seized with mixed feelings of nostalgia and sadness. Not only was the writing chaotic, the message itself was rambling and imprecise.
Since I left you at Mount Ibuki, I haven't forgotten the village. And I haven't forgotten my old friend. By accident, I heard your name at the Yoshioka school. At the time, I got confused and couldn't decide whether to try to see you. Now I'm in a sake shop. I've had a lot to drink.
Thus far, the meaning was clear enough, but from this point on, the letter was difficult to follow.
Ever since I parted from you, I've been kept in a cage of lust, and idleness has eaten into my bones. For 5 years, I've spent my days in a stupor, doing nothing. In the capital, you are now famous as a swordsman. I drink to you. Some people say Musashi is a coward, good only at running away. Some say you're an incomparable swordsman. I don't care which is true. I'm just happy that your sword has the people in the capital talking. You're smart. You should be able to make your way with the sword. But as I look back, I wonder about me, the way I am now. I'm a fool. How can a stupid wretch like me face a wise friend like you without dying of shame? But wait, life is long, and it's too early to say what the future will bring. I don't want to see you now, but there will come a day when I will. I pray for your health.
Then came a rapidly scrawled postscript informing him, at some length, that the Yoshioka school took a serious view of the recent incident, that they were looking everywhere for him, and that he should be careful about his movements. It ended,
You mustn't die now that you're just beginning to make a name for yourself. When I, too, have made something of myself, I want to see you and talk over old times. Take care of yourself. Stay alive, so you can be an inspiration to me.
Matahachi had no doubt meant well, but there was something twisted about his attitude. Why must he praise Musashi so, and in the next breath carry on so about his own failings?
Why, wondered Musashi. Couldn't he just write and say that it's been a long time, and why don't we get together and have a long talk?
Joe, did you ask this man for his address?
No.
Did the people at the shop know him?
I don't think so.
Did he come there often?
No, this was the first time.
Musashi was thinking that if he knew where Matahachi lived, he would go back to Kyoto right now to see him. He wanted to talk to his childhood comrade, try to bring him to his senses, reawaken in him the spirit he had once had. Since he still considered Matahachi to be his friend, he would have liked to pull him out of his present mood with its apparently self-destructive tendencies. And of course, he would also have liked to have Matahachi explain to his mother what a mistake she was making. The two walked on silently. They were on their way down the mountain at Daigo, and the Rokujizo crossing was visible below them. Abruptly, Musashi turned to the boy and said,
Joe, there's something I want you to do for me.
What is it?
I want you to go on an errand.
Where to?
Kyoto.
That means turning around and going back where I just came from.
That's right.
I want you to take a letter from me to the Yoshioka School on Shijō Avenue." Jotaro, crestfallen, kicked a rock with his toe.
"Don't you want to go?"
asked Musashi, looking him in the face. Jotaro shook his head uncertainly.
"I don't mind going, but aren't you just doing this to get rid of me?"
His suspicion made Musashi feel guilty, for wasn't he the one who had broken the child's faith in adults?
"No," he said vigorously. "A samurai does not lie. Forgive me for what happened this morning. It was just a mistake."
"All right, I'll go." Entering a tea house at the crossroads known as Roku Amida, they ordered tea and ate lunch. Musashi then wrote a letter, which he addressed to Yoshioka Seijuro. "I am told that you and your disciples are searching for me. As it happens, I am now on the Yamato High Road, my intention being to travel around in the general area of Iga and Ise for about a year to continue my study of swordsmanship. I do not wish to change my plans at this time, but since I regret as much as you do that I was unable to meet you during my previous visit to your school, I should like to inform you that I shall certainly be back in the capital by the first or the second month of next year. Between now and then, I expect to improve my technique considerably. I trust that you yourself will not neglect your practice. It would be a great shame if Yoshioka Kenpo's flourishing school were to suffer a second defeat like the one it sustained the last time I was there. In closing, I send my respectful wishes for your continued good health. Shinmen Miyamoto Musashi Masana." Though the letter was polite, it left little doubt as to Musashi's confidence in himself. Having amended the address to include not only Seijuro, but all the disciples in the school, he laid down his brush and gave the letter to Jotaro.
"Can I just throw it in at the school and come back?" the boy asked.
"No. You must call at the front entrance and hand it personally to the servant there."
"I understand."
"There's something else I want you to do, but it may be a little difficult."
"What is it?"
"I want you to see if you can find the man who gave you the letter. His name is Honiden Matahachi. He's an old friend of mine."
"That should be no trouble at all."
"You think not? Just how do you propose to do it?"
"Oh, I'll ask around at all the drinking shops."
Musashi laughed. "That's not a bad idea. I gather from Matahachi's letter, however, that he knows somebody at the Yoshioka school. I think it would be quicker to ask about him there."
"What do I do when I find him?"
"I want you to deliver a message. Tell him that from the first to the seventh day of the new year, I'll go every morning to the Great Bridge at Gojo Avenue and wait for him. Ask him to come on one of those days to meet me."
"Is that all?"
"Yes. But also tell him that I want very badly to see him."
"All right, I think I have it. Where will you be when I come back?"
"I'll tell you what. When I get to Nara, I'll arrange it so that you can find out where I am by asking at the Hozoin. That's the temple that's famous for its lance technique."
"You'll really do that?"
"Ah, you're still suspicious, aren't you? Don't worry. If I don't keep my promise this time, you can cut off my head." Musashi was still laughing as he left the tea house. Outside, he turned toward Nara, and Jotaro set off in the opposite direction toward Kyoto. The crossroads was a jumble of people under basket hats, of swallows, and of neighing horses. As the boy made his way through the throng, he looked back and saw Musashi standing where he had been, watching him. They smiled a distant farewell, and each went on his way. A Spring Breeze. On the bank of the Takase River, Akemi was rinsing a strip of cloth and singing a song she had learned at the Okuni Kabuki. Each time she pulled at the flower-patterned cloth, it created an illusion of swirling cherry blossoms. "The breeze of love tugs at the sleeve of my kimono. Oh, the sleeve weighs heavy. Is the breeze of love heavy?" Jotaro stood on top of the dike. His lively eyes surveyed the scene and he smiled amicably.
You sing well, Auntie, he called out.
What's that? Asked Akemi. She looked up at the gnome-like child with his long wooden sword and his enormous basket hat.
Who are you? She asked. And what do you mean, calling me Auntie? I'm still young.
Okay, sweet young girl. How's that?
Stop it, she said with a laugh. You're much too little to be flirting.